Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, we'll be taking an inspirational look at TESE, an ecumenical community that draws thousands of young people to its doors in France. And what you didn't know about nuns, an eye-opening overview of convent life in the tumultuous times of the Protestant Reformation and the French Revolution. I'll be talking with historian Silvia Evangelisti about her new book. Thanks for joining me. One of Pope John Paul II's and Pope Benedict's deepest wishes has been the union of Christianity's churches of East and West. For well over half a century, a once small community in France's southern Burgundy region has been trying to put that desire into practice. TESE has grown into a worldwide ecumenical movement, especially involving young people. It has become a byword for ecumenism based on prayer and meditation. TESE is the name of a unique monastic community in France that groups more than 100 men, Protestants and Catholics, from 25 different nations. Young people from all over the world visit TESE to be part of community life for a week at a time. Depending on the season, the number of young visitors each week ranges from a few hundred in the winter months to several thousand during the summer vacation period. During Holy Week leading up to Easter, more than 10,000 young people flock to the community, by far the highest number of visitors of the whole year. The TESE community was founded in 1940 by Brother Roger, who remained its leader until he was killed in 2005. Its current prior is Brother Alois, a German Catholic appointed by Brother Roger to be his successor. In a recent visit to Rome, Brother Alois was received in audience by Pope Benedict. Afterwards, he spoke to Susie Hodges about the TESE philosophy and his meeting with the Pope.
He had so touching, wonderful words about Brother Roger after the death of Brother Roger, and still 1 year afterwards, at the anniversary of the death of Brother Roger, he spoke in such deep words about him, and this created for us a very deep link. And he was very interested in how the community continues and what is happening with the young people. Yes.
And what message did he give you for the TESE community?
He encouraged to continue on the way of looking for Christ, going towards Christ with the young people in the communion of the church. And this was also the message of Brother Roger. We cannot find Christ without the communion of the church. To open ourselves for the others and to look for Christ, this is the same movement. And I think it's the same perspective that we have in TESE together with the Holy Father.
And what do you think makes TESE unique? Because it's often described that way, isn't it?
No, we are not unique. We are one community, a monastic community that lives in the church and that wants to give a contribution for reconciliation. And today for the question how to transmit faith to the next generation. But we do this together with so many people.
Now, I know that TESE is visited each year by thousands and thousands of young people. What do they tell you they're seeking?
A sense for their life. And I think for many young people, this is really an existential question now that they bring. They formulate it less or more clearly, but they come with this question. And what can give sense to my life? How is it possible to believe today in God in our modern society where we are minority? Young people suffer sometimes from the fact that looking for faith brings them in a situation of minority. Nobody understands this. And to deal with these situations, that's important.
And what kind of feedback do you get afterwards? Can you tell us about some particularly memorable feedback you get from some of these young people? Some chance remark?
Oh, so many letters we receive or young people who come back. Often they say, for example, in Taizé, the silence has been important for me. And isn't this astonishing? In our society, where young people want to always to have a noise and always fill out silence, because silence means solitude. The modern life does not give a place for silence. Very often they say silence has been important, and this means that they discover perhaps in Taizé a deeper longing that is present, but that does not come to the surface in daily life. The same thing with simplicity. People say the simplicity in the life of Taizé, it has to be simple because the young people give a financial contribution to the life there, and we cannot have very luxurious means in Taizé. But the simplicity, and this also goes against the modern life, so a deeper longing is awakened.
How easy was it for the Taizé community to carry on after the horrifying assassination of Brother Roger? An act of violence in a community of peace.
Yes, it was horrifying, yes. But at the same time, we were carried, and I cannot say it in a different way, we were carried by God and by the communion of the Church. And this allowed that we continued immediately to continue to welcome the young people, to continue the prayer life, to continue with the European meetings, to go to Calcutta, to go now to Bolivia, to go into the situations of the young people. And now I can say that the young people understood that Brother Roger did not point towards himself, but like John the Baptist, he pointed towards Christ and towards the communion of the Church. And the young people understand this. And the prayer life continues in the same, with the same intense way. And we were astonished that during last summer there were more young people coming than before.
How many young people do you get on average a week during the summer?
3,000, 4,000, 5,000 each week. And from all the countries and other continents also. Those coming from other continents are prepared by their local churches and they stay for 2 or 3 months in Taizé. But the people from Europe only stay for 1 week. Some do stay another week for having a week of retreat in silence. But for example, from Romania, we have each week 10 buses coming. And most of them are Orthodox, but also Catholics and Protestants.
You are a musician, and I know you've written many of the newer Taizé songs, which are sung throughout the world today. How easy is it for you to write these songs? Do you get a sudden flash of inspiration? And what are the main themes of them?
Oh, we speak together among the brothers. What can be the text? Because it's the words that we want to sing, and it's words from the Psalms, from the Bible, but also from the tradition of the Church. We have to decide the language. We sing in Latin, because this still unites the young people from everywhere. So we have some Latin songs that we sing, but also we sing in different languages. And then we find a melody and a harmony, and we start to sing.
Finally, how do you foresee Taizé's future? Are you seeing any change or shift in its activities or its direction or the countries where you'll be involved?
Oh, we still have to go further step by step concerning this question. But the fact that we have smaller youth meetings on other continents, it's something that Brother Roger did. He went to India, to the Philippines, to South Africa, to Latin America. But we want to revive this now, to have youth meetings on the other continents too.
And do you find that these young people who are getting together with people of other religions, it's breaking down their prejudices about somebody who doesn't share the same faith as them?
Oh, it's a long way, you know, but if we can diminish the fears of one another, because these fears are source of misunderstandings and then even hatred and not having peace. If we can tear down the barriers of fear a little bit, then it's a contribution for peace.
Thanks there to Taizé Prior, Brother Alois, who was speaking to my colleague Susie Hodges.
Well, for more information on the Taizé community, check out their website. That's Taizé, T-A-I-Z-E, .fr for France. Here in Rome, especially outside our offices near St. Peter's, you can't miss them. Nuns! Nuns in black habits, brown habits, white habits, gray habits. With a trained eye, you can even pick out the non-habit-wearing nuns from their hairstyles, crosses, and long skirts. There are so many nuns here that it's quite a shock sometimes when I travel elsewhere and don't see them bustling around the busy streets. For me, nuns are a part of Rome's multicolored scenery. So that's why when a book called Nuns was recently deposited on my desk, I didn't take much notice of it at first. But then I saw the whole title, A History of Convent Life. Did nuns have a history? I was sure they did, but I didn't know much about it. I opened the cover. Nuns, poets and playwrights, actresses and actors, musicians and composers, singers and choir masters, gifted artists and prized portrait painters. Not just cloistered women living a gray life behind gray walls, but battle-ready defenders of the faith, prepared to fight tooth and nail to protect their convents. Nuns. Silvia Evangelisti's book, Nuns, A History of Convent Life, is an eye-opener even for people like me who are surrounded by nuns every day. I'm familiar with the self-sacrificing work they do for others, the teaching, the cooking, the health caring they do in places as far away as the remotest African village to the soup kitchens down the street in Rome. Even nuns like my 11th grade history teacher, tennis-shoed and breathless Sister Bernadette, who always erupted into the classroom with racket in hand. But this other side to nuns was new to me. Evangelisti narrows her research down to a specific period of nun history, from 1450 to about the year 1700. Three tumultuous centuries that brought about sweeping religious, social, political, and artistic changes across Europe and beyond. It was an era that formed the backbone of the nuns we know today. I was intrigued, so I tracked down Evangelisti at the East Anglia University in England, where she was teaching a class on European history. Why did women choose to go into convent life? Who were some of these extraordinary history-making heroines she highlights in her book? I had a lot of questions to ask her, beginning with, who were the first nuns? Why, the very first Christians, she said, especially those women who followed Christ and his disciples.
Communities of religious women or nuns developed rather early, and then they developed in a variety of associative forms, we could say. Certainly by the 4th and 5th century, we already find women living in communities, therefore nuns, and we also find the first rules addressed to nuns in order to structure their collective life.
Now, what made you so interested in telling the stories of women who decided to take up religious life? It doesn't seem to be a very common subject.
Well, it is quite common now. In the last 10 to 15 years, at least, there has been a proliferation of books, articles, of exhibitions on nuns or related to nuns. My specific interest in nuns, I think that, well, first of all, because I have an interest in gender history, therefore I'm quite interested in corporate female life, let's say, then I think that also convents and in general institution offer a variety of sources that for historians are fundamental. And then I also think that I was very interested in, you know, exploring different forms of women's life that were in a way alternative to marriage, therefore alternative to family, procreation, husbands, etc.
In your introduction, you say that nuns have recently have attracted many fans. How
yes.
so? And where do you see that?
Well, first of all, in the huge bibliography on nuns that you can find in very many areas of research, not only in history, but also in art history, music, architecture history, and so on. So we are really witnessing, I think, now a kind of, yeah, I would say a success of nuns in the sense that we now are more and more able to read about not only their spiritual life, but also their intellectual life or their social engagement, their capacity in producing books and texts of all sorts, and being engaged in the various type of visual arts and so on. And recently there have been exhibition also on nuns artists or artist nuns, and I see an interest in this.
Now, in your book, you are focusing really on the history of convents, let's say, and nuns from the late 15th to the early 18th century.
Yes.
Why did you choose that specific period? Of course, it was fraught with the upheaval for the Catholic Church, the
yes.
Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, the French Revolution in the
yes.
18th century. Why did you choose that period?
Well, first of all, for all the reasons you just mentioned, it is a period of great changes, although probably historians would argue that any period is a period of great changes, but certainly the sort of pre-Reformation and then the Reformation, the Catholic Reformation and then the French Revolution already are big, huge events of history to which we're all more or less, with which we're all more or less familiar. And but my specific interest is that, well, first of all, this period is my period of research, and therefore I know more about this early modern period than about other periods. And also because I think that this period offered me the possibility not to focus too strictly on nuns and religious history, but to link it with the great artistic and intellectual development of the European Renaissance, to link nuns to the early colonies and the missionary enterprise, and also to link nuns to other type of religious associative life of open communities of women similar to nuns, but not strictly speaking nuns who took the solemn vows.
And why did a woman back then choose to become a nun? I'm talking about the history you're focusing on again,
yes.
from the 15th to the 18th centuries. Who were the kind of women who would have gone into convent life back then?
So I think that there were a variety of reasons why women enter the convent. The first one, of course, the idea of or the attraction of spiritual life, rather detached from worldly life. The second reason being family pressure. Convents were kind of cheaper option to marriage. The convent fee was much cheaper than the dowry, the marriage dowry. Therefore, families who were quite well off or with huge patrimonies prefer the cheaper option.
I'm sorry, I wasn't aware that a woman back then did have to pay to get into a convent. Is
yes.
that right?
Yeah, there was a convent fee, and sometimes they were quite high. Therefore, these fees, in a way, restricted the kind of recruitment and restricted the recruitment of convent to mostly the elite, although not only elite women enter the convent, but also quite humble women enter, but as servant nuns, therefore, to serve and to do the heavy duties, the manual work for the community.
Were the first convents cloistered, and then did other more open forms of convent life develop? Or did these two forms of monastic life develop actually simultaneously?
I think that there were always two forms of monastic life, one more closed, subjected to strict enclosure and to enclosure rules, and one more open, the so-called tertiaries. I mean, enclosure was always implicit in the idea of monasticism, including for men, the idea that devoting your life to Christ was a way to withdraw from the world and so on. It really became a universal law at the end of the 13th century, although it wasn't very much observed, and then it became the big issue for nuns with the Council of Trent, and it was at that point also implemented in very many convents in the Western world.
You mentioned there the Council of Trent, the Reformation. In what other ways did monastic life change after that Council of Trent?
Well, certainly the Council of Trent was a kind of watershed for the life of convents, and the Reformation was obviously another very, very powerful element of change in Reformation Europe, in particular for the period that I'm looking at. I can speak mainly for that. Convents were closed down, monasteries too, and Luther spoke against the idea of female and male celibacy, and that there was no need for this. But still, at the same time, convents survived, and also they survived in a kind of hybrid form as Protestant convents. So there is a great deal to say about this, a great research to still do, and this can also link in a way the Catholic and the Protestant world. I mean, it's enough to think that one of the icon of 17th century feminism, British feminism, Mary Astell, wrote about her fascination for a Protestant nunnery as a place where women could live and at the same time live as single women, but maybe dedicating themselves to study and so on.
In your book, you say that nuns throughout the ages have been involved in some very courageous activity outside the convent. They've been very involved in social work, more so than many lay women and men. How so?
Well, this is the sort of other, more open form of female religious collective life that I think is very interesting, and this is a bit less studied than the cloistered form. A number of congregations and organizations of religious women were created after, in particular, the Council of Trent, and they engaged in social work in direct contact with the community. Therefore, they were not cloistered, but they actually went out and they worked in hospitals, in prisons, teaching the prisoners, in a way, the basic of Christian doctrine, as well as caring for their physical health and so on, or preparing food, for instance, for soldiers during the war, or for the poor and so on. So these were the nuns that did not come very often from an elite background, but from a kind of less elite background and more humble, and they in a way did the dirty job and they dirtied their hands.
After conducting all of this research, do you yourself have any particular nun heroes?
I do. I have a series of nun heroes, and some are very well known, like Teresa of Avila, the Spanish religious reformer who wrote a huge amount of pages, her autobiography first, or one of the artists that was quoted by Vasari in his life, Plautilla Nelli, the Florentine Plautilla Nelli, who painted a number of works for monasteries as well as for Florentine patricians who commissioned her a number of paintings, and also Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, the Mexican nun to whom Octavio Paz devoted a great biography. and she was one of the first nuns to speak in favor of women and women access to education and so on. So she's one of these image or these nuns that in a way connect the religious Western tradition to the early feminist tradition. The history of nuns, like every type of history, is a history of changes through the centuries. I think that there are still a number of aspects of nuns that needs to be discovered there. For instance, participation to the civil war in Spain, etc.
In what way? Now you've piqued my curiosity there.
There are a number of sources that would suggest that nuns were quite engaged in the Spanish Civil War, and that they also risked their lives and their works together with other women in a kind of resistance, and therefore this is a completely unknown aspect of the nuns' history that is still there to be discovered.
Would you say that nuns, at least their changing roles throughout the centuries, could they be role models for women today?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are a variety of role models for women, but certainly, in a way, yes. I mean, certainly a model of life that is not only associated to motherhood, but is also associated to work for the others, if you see what I mean.
Yes. And I can't help myself but ask, do you teach about nuns as well? And what's the reaction in your classes?
They're all very interested, actually. I do teach about nuns, and it's a fascinating topic. As I said, you can link it very easily to very many aspects of history. And the students like it because they think it's absolutely something that they didn't know. It's really a novelty to their sort of knowledge. And they're very interested also because, in a way, what I teach them goes against some of the most obvious commonplaces about nuns. And then you also have to consider that the majority of my students do not come from a Catholic background. Therefore, for them, there is also this kind of additional element of learning about something quite different from what they know.
Have you ever had a student come up to you after class and say, gee, that was really interesting, I didn't know that, and that's worth looking into more deeply?
Yes, I have. They like doing research on this. They like writing on this. And there are a number of students now working on religious art, for instance, who are very interested in female religious art. Yes, I think that the students respond very well to nuns.
Then you walk right into my darkness.
History professor Silvia Evangelisti there, speaking about her book, Nuns, A History of Convent Life.
You hold me like a child till my frozen tears fall at your feet. You can have my heart if you don't mind broken things. You can have my heart if you don't mind these tears. But I heard that you make all things new, so I give these pieces all to you. If you want it, you can have my heart.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.